Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my pleasure to introduce you to the music you'll be hearing at the festival. For Music at Menlo's 17th season, we'll explore seven incredible decades, singular periods in Western music history that saw intense concentration of the art form's evolution at the hands of its greatest innovators. We'll hear music of the 1710s, when Bach created some of his most inspired instrumental music. On our second and third concert programs, we'll visit the 1790s, when Beethoven emerged as the heir apparent to Haydn and Mozart, and the 1820s, when Beethoven and his own natural successor, Franz Schubert, penned their profound final works. From there, we'll visit the apex of the Romantic period, hearing music from the 1840s by Schumann, Chopin, and Mendelssohn. We'll hear the explosion of new musical styles that marked the 1890s and the Roaring Twenties. And our musical time travel will conclude with the final decade of the last millennium, with works by some of today's vital compositional voices. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han and Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
In 1921, Russian influence expanded in the East, the Miss America pageant was born, and for the first time, baseball was heard on the radio. The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald's immortal documentation of the hedonistic jazz age, was published in 1925. 4 years later, Wall Street crashed, bringing a decade of prosperity to an end. These years likewise saw Romanticism's cinematic legacy come to life in the music of Erich Wolfgang Korngold, while nationalist fervor found voice in Ravel's Basque rhythms and Bartok's folk-inspired modernism. Half a world away, a young George Gershwin emerged as an icon of the Roaring Twenties in the United States. Prokofiev's five melodies for violin and piano are a transcription of his Five Songs Without Words, Opus 35, originally composed in 1920 for the mezzo-soprano Nina Koschets. Certain hallmarks of Prokofiev's language, namely the impish and at times caustic wit that characterizes so much of his chamber and symphonic output, defer in these five miniatures to an unabashed lyricism. The composer was touring California while at work on the Songs Without Words, and that state's natural beauty may have had something to do with the character of these pieces. In his diary, the composer recorded his impression of, quote, the ocean, which, at sunset, shimmered with the most beautiful colors, end quote.
Their concentration of lyricism does not, however, preclude the five melodies' expressive range. The dreamy wistfulness of the first leads naturally into the tender second movement, which for a brief moment shows its teeth.
Thank you.
The third, in turn, marked animato, launches a nervous frenzy. The fourth tune, equal parts sly delicacy and winsome charm, seems tailored for a Woody Allen film. The set concludes with the most enigmatic of the five, a dreamlike reverie redolent of the first movement. Momentarily offset by an angular middle section.
The five melodies honor three violinists who impelled their conception. Prokofiev first had the idea to compose a set of songs without words for violin and piano upon hearing the Hungarian virtuoso Joseph Zsigeti in recital. A personal acquaintance, the violinist Cecilia Hansen, insisted that the second of the Opus 35 songs would idiomatically fit the violin. Thus encouraged, Prokofiev consulted Pavel Kashansky, the muse for his first violin concerto, and produced transcriptions of the entire set in just 2 hours. The first, third, and fourth of the five melodies are dedicated to Kachansky, the second to Hansen, and the fifth to Zsigeti. The early 1920s saw Maurice Ravel freshly recovered from a steady assault of physically and emotionally traumatic events. Dysentery, the psychic strain of the Second World War, and the death of his mother, with whom he was especially close. This period also marked an important development in Ravel's professional life, with the passing in 1918 of Claude Debussy, with whom Ravel had tired of being so often compared. Ravel was now uniformly recognized as France's preeminent composer. Ravel thus completed the Sonata for Violin and Cello against the backdrop of personal crisis and transition. The sonata accordingly reflects a turning point in his musical language. It most explicitly acknowledges this critical period with its dedication à la mémoire de Claude Debussy. Musically, the sonata foreshadows a direction that Ravel would increasingly pursue until his death in 1937. It exemplifies the principle of dépouillement, economy of means, that Debussy advocated and which had characterized his own final works. Ravel noted that, quote, "The music is stripped down to the bone. The allure of harmony is rejected, and increasingly there is a return of emphasis on melody." End quote.
The sonata's dépouillement is immediately evident in the austere sound world created by its instrumental forces, pared down to two melodic instruments without the benefit of a piano to provide the harmonic foundation. The work's cyclic form, that is, the recurrence of thematic material from the first movement in each of the subsequent three movements, further demonstrates an economy of means. Two germinal motives, presented in the opening allegro, provide the basis for much of the sonata. The first of these is the alternation between major and minor chords, outlined by the violin in the work's opening measures. This major-minor seesaw provides a harmonic underpinning in the absence of a piano and reappears throughout the work, most audibly in the propulsive engine of the scherzo. Moments after the sonata's lyrical opening, the cello introduces the angular secondary theme, a series of wide leaps. This gesture likewise recurs throughout the work, most notably at the climax of the final movement. The sonata is rife with sonic ingenuities and ambiguities created by Ravel's imaginative treatment of the two instruments. The cello often plays above the violin, resulting in mesmerizing aural illusions, where the listener is unsure of who is playing what. Composite lines, constructed from fragments played by each instrument, are likewise highly original. Witness the short but magical coda to the first movement. While the sonata's thematic material coheres organically, each of the work's four movements presents a unique, expressive character. The lyricism of the first movement is challenged by the fierce, polyrhythmic scherzo. A rustic, folk-like melody in the second movement furthermore betrays Ravel's fascination with gypsy music. The long, sustained melodic lines of the contemplative slow movement highlight the vocal expressivity of the violin and cello. Even as it accelerates to an energized frenzy, the music retains an essential lyricism until returning to the movement's opening material and subsiding to a muted conclusion. The final movement, marked vif avec entrain, lively with spirit, offers a generous stream of complementary melodic ideas.
Alongside the quartets of Haydn, Beethoven, and Shostakovich, Béla Bartók's six-string quartets constitute one of the repertoire's most influential cycles. Throughout these works, which span three decades of the composer's career, Bartók reimagines this most essential chamber music genre, exploring structural ideas, sonic possibilities, and novel instrumental techniques. The shortest of the six quartets is also perhaps the most rigorously conceived of the set. Upon the publication of Bartók's String Quartet No. 3 in 1929, Theodor Adorno hailed it as, quote, unquestionably the best of the Hungarian's works to date, end quote. The third quartet weds ingenious formal innovation with the musical preoccupations, namely Hungarian folk music and Bachian technique, that would distinguish so much of Bartók's mature music. Adorno continues, quote, what is decisive is the formative power of the work, the iron concentration, the wholly original tectonics. Hungarian types and German sonata are fused together in the white heat of impatient compositional effort. From them, truly contemporary form is created. End quote.
The quartet comprises one continuous movement divided into four sections, marked prima parte, or first part, seconda parte, recapitulation of the first part, and coda. A stark contrast between the prima parte and seconda parte animates the quartet. The understated prima parte is founded on a germinal three-note cell, an ascending fourth, followed by a descending third. Bartók develops this cell throughout to extract a broad range of expressive characters. The primary theme of the Allegro second part, presented first in pizzicato chords by the cello, then viola, is a simple rising and falling scalar figure. Following the weighty pensiveness of the prima parte, this music swings with the rhythmic verve of a folk dance. Here, Bartók develops his material using a stocked arsenal of compositional techniques, both ancient and modern. He makes use of augmentation, or elongation of note values, diminution, shortening of note values, and inversion, the statement of a melody upside down, techniques redolent of Bach. Thank you. The seconda parte also features two fugato sections. Yet, while conjuring the spirit of Bach, such modern coloristic effects as collegno, using the wood rather than the hair of the bow, sul ponticello, bowing near the bridge to produce a glassy sound, and more give the music a quintessentially Bartokian sonic profile. In music scholar Stephen Walsh's hearing of the third quartet, Bartok, quote, felt the work to be in two movements whose final sections had become detached from the main body in each case, end quote. The Ricapitulazione della Prima Parte indeed returns to the material from the quartet's first part, but rather than recapitulate the prima parte in the traditional sense, quite liberally transforms earlier musical ideas. The coda could equally well have been designated recapitulation of the second part, as it similarly recalls material of the quartet's middle section.
More than 70 years after his death, George Gershwin remains a vital part of America's musical profile. Gershwin composed some of the most iconic tunes ever written, from the unforgettable melodies in Rhapsody in Blue and An American in Paris, to standards like Someone to Watch Over Me and Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, which, beyond the scope of the musical world, have become hallmarks of American culture. Born in Brooklyn in 1898 to Russian immigrant parents, Gershwin began his musical career as a Tin Pan Alley song plugger. By age 20, he had risen to prominence as a composer of Broadway shows. Alongside his meteoric professional ascent in the arena of popular music, he also received classical instruction in harmony, counterpoint, form, and orchestration, beginning in 1915 from the composer and violinist Edward Kielenyi. He composed his first classical work, The Lullaby for String Quartet, as a harmony exercise for Kielenyi.
The lullaby is at once technically sound and in character unassuming. Its leisurely lilting melody would not be out of the place in a Broadway show. And indeed, Gershwin later reused the tune for the number Has Anyone Seen My Joe? In his 1922 musical Blue Monday. But Gershwin decorates its unpretentious melody with such magical slides of musical invention. A beguiling arpeggio presented at the outset in glassy violin harmonics becomes the cello ostinato. Thank you. and recurrences of the primary material are transformed by subtle changes in instrumental texture. Though hardly aspiring to enter the realm of Beethoven's and Schubert's quartets, the attention to technique demonstrated here suggests that Gershwin could just as well have succeeded as a composer of serious music. Even the most avant-garde of his contemporaries surely agreed. When Gershwin toured Europe in 1928, he was treated to a private performance of Alban Berg's hyper-expressionist lyric suite. When Berg asked in turn to hear some of Gershwin's music, the composer of Swanee and Oh Lady Be Good hesitated. Berg dismissed his concerns. "Mr. Gershwin," he said, "music is music."
The music critic Julius Korngold's decision to honor Mozart, Western music's most notorious wunderkind, when naming his second son turned out to be prescient indeed. Erich Wolfgang Korngold was, in his own right, a child prodigy on the order of Wolfgang Amadeus. In 1906, Korngold composed a cantata and played it for Mahler, who declared the 9-year-old a genius. 2 years later, he completed an opera, Der Schneemann, which premiered to great acclaim in Vienna. Encountering the young Korngold's work, Richard Strauss observed, quote, "One's first reaction that these compositions are by a child are those of awe and concern that so precocious a genius should follow its normal development. This assurance of style, this mastery of form, this characteristic expressiveness, this bold harmony are truly astonishing." End quote. The height of Korngold's early fame came in 1920 with the opera Die Tote Stadt. He thereafter remained active in the composition of instrumental chamber and orchestral music, but at 23 had firmly established dramatic music as an essential component of his musical identity. In 1934, the director Max Reinhardt invited Korngold to Hollywood to score his film adaptation of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. This launched one of the greatest musical careers in cinematic history. Korngold pioneered the symphonic film score, giving the golden age of Hollywood its signature sound. He created much of his finest music for film and garnered Academy Awards for his scores to Anthony Adverse in 1936 and The Adventures of Robin Hood in 1938.
Though composed more than a decade before A Midsummer Night's Dream, the piano quintet in E major, Opus 15, completed in 1921, embodies the dramatic sweep, instinct for impassioned melody, and ear for lush instrumental textures that ensured his success in Hollywood. Audibly placing Korngold in the post-romantic tradition of Strauss and Liszt, the quintet transposes the large-scale orchestral sensibility of those composers' tone poems to the plane of chamber music. Its very sound, from the bright opening theme of the first movement, is rich, decadent, cinematic. The movement likewise displays textural variety, as in the second theme. The hefty chords of the opening yield to a suave melody in the cello, accompanied by a twinkling piano accompaniment. A moment later, the tempo slows as piano and cello, in their lowest registers, introduce a new, ominous idea. A broad sonic palette supports a range of musical characters throughout, but the optimism of the movement's opening measures ultimately prevails. In the deeply felt Adagio second movement, Korngold composes a set of variations on the song Mond, so gehst du wieder auf, Moon, thou risest thus again, from his Abschiedslieder, Opus 14. The song, on a poem by Ernst Lothar, expresses the composer's romantic yearning for the young actress Luzi von Sonnenthal, whose disapproving parents insisted on 1 year's separation before the couple's courtship could proceed. The two eventually married in 1924. Moon, thou risest thus again, over the dark valley of unwept tears. Ah, I feel the depths of my being. The heart that has suffered separation will burn eternally. Korngold's treatment of this text, in both the Opus 14 song setting and in the piano quintet, is tender and beguiling. It displays a melodic gift in line with such American popular songwriters as Harold Arlen and Jerome Kern. So is it rife with sly, heady harmonic turns that betray Korngold, the Hollywood composer, as a product of post-romantic European expressionism. A dramatic prologue launches the exuberant final movement. Strings in unison state a proud forte gesture, answered by pesante chords in the piano. The first violin spins a recitative-like cadenza, pointing the ensemble towards the movement's main allegro giocoso material. Thank you. As throughout the previous movements, Korngold's dramatic gifts are on display in this boisterous finale, and the quintet concludes on a lively note.
Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering was provided by Dahong Situ. Production support was provided by Nathan Pear. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Sergei Prokofiev's Five Melodies for Violin and Piano, performed by Gidon Kramer and Martha Argerich, and Béla Bartók's String Quartet No. 3, performed by the Emerson String Quartet, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Maurice Ravel's Sonata for Violin and Cello, performed by Yura Lee and Jakob Karanyi, George Gershwin's Lullaby, performed by the Escher String Quartet, and Eric Wolfgang Korngold's Piano Quintet, performed by Gloria Chen, Kristen Lee, Sean Lee, Richard O'Neill, and Mihai Marika, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.